All set? 14th class in the Then and Now series. Tonight, January the 22nd, 2008. Tonight we look at the chapter on karma. Not sure where I saw this or heard about this. If I saw it, it was on some video on the web, but my friend and colleague, Stephen Batchelor, was asked about karma. And he said, well, in the East, karma explains everything, which means that it explains nothing. I think it's good to keep that in mind as we look into this. In our culture, not in our little Buddhist subsect of this culture, but in our culture as a whole, what's the traditional explanation or characterization might be a better word. When things happen that and we have we don't know why.
Shit happens.
Well, I was thinking of a more traditional one than that.
Fate, punishment, luck.
Yeah, fate, punishment, luck, all of these things. Well, that was it, yes. Well, it used to be said, it's God's will. So, there's both a significant difference and an important similarity that I want to take note of. First, one of the perspectives we've been using in this series of classes is where the name for the class comes from is a contrast between traditional perspectives and contemporary perspectives, or frameworks may be a better word to use. And in a traditional society, one of the characteristics of a traditional culture or society is that there is one overarching worldview that is accepted by everybody. And one of the characteristics of a modern society is that there is not one overarching worldview that is accepted by everybody. Actually, suppose we get into postmodernism, then in the modern society, the overarching worldview is the scientific, rational one. And these two expressions, it's God's will, or it's karma, remember the teacher that I used to translate for in Vancouver is his way of saying it. When karma come, what can do? Which was often used as an abdication of personal responsibility in a difficult situation. Both of these are expressions of an overarching worldview. And they aren't really explanations. One of the significant influences on my approach to translation is the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who is arguably one of the pivotal philosophers of the first half of the 20th century. He paid extremely close attention to the way words were used. For he felt that many philosophical problems were generated by using words in ways that they weren't ordinarily used or used in ordinary language. So they seemed to be questions, but there weren't any questions there. And when I'm going to use the one that's more familiar to our culture. When one uses the phrase, it's God's will, is that an explanation? Let's take a very different case. When you say, look at something, and you say, that's beautiful. Is that a description of a quality that is inherent in the thing that you're looking at? Or is it an expression of your own state of mind? Now, when we say something's beautiful, most of the time, it's just an expression of our own state of mind. That's how we relate to it. This has not stopped people arguing about what is beauty for 3,000-4,000 years, and still rages today, and just as inconclusive as it's always been. So, what state of mind is it's God's will an expression of? This time, use the microphones, please. There's one there. Where's the other one? Right. Okay, good. So what state of mind is that an expression of? When would you use that phrase? I mean, when would that phrase be used? Raquel?
When you're sort of relinquishing control.
Okay, when you're relinquishing control. You want to go a little further?
I mean, it could be, that could go in a couple different directions, I guess, from okay. there. It could be because you can't explain it, or because you don't want to take responsibility for it, or...
Okay. Anybody else? Randy?
It seems to me it's often used as an expression of acceptance.
Or trying to move in that direction, okay?
Making an effort there.
Yeah. Anybody else? Art.
Yeah, I was going to say basically the same thing, sort of resignation.
Which is, there's resignation, there's acceptance, and, you know, they're not quite the same thing. But okay. Well, let's take that one a little further. Why resignation? What are you resigning to? Interesting. In that case, we say, what are we resigning to, not what are we resigning from.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes, I think at those times, we'd like to resign from something as well.
It's interesting. What's popping into mind are just flashes of things. Control, responsibility, engagement, responding, all of those things. To phrase it differently, it's just a very passive state of mind, a very... Um, almost kind of like hitting the snooze button on an alarm. here's a bad situation, or whatever, and it's God's will. Hit the button, go back to sleep, and don't think about it anymore.
That's a little cynical, I think, but... Chuck? I'll come back to that.
I think it's more of a way of explaining something that can't be explained very well. Like, yeah. Something bad happened and, to somebody good, and you're trying to say, well, there really isn't any explanation, so it must be God's will.
What do you think, Art? It's interesting. Would you ever use that as something good happened to a really bad person?
Well, you might. You might think it, at least. Yes, that gives you sort of a warm and fuzzy.
Because I don't think it has to be. We tend to associate it more with tragic or difficult events, but it can also be applied to positive events. Kara?
Well, I mean, you said that, and the first thing that comes to mind is like when somebody like goes on to accept an award or something on television, and the first person they thank is Jesus. Like,
they score a touchdown in football. And
that Jesus down. Somehow has a deeply entrenched investment in the Grammys.
Yeah, we do run into that, which is a kind of naive religion.
Doesn't have anything else to do.
Yes. But we say, or we would use the phrase, it's God's will, when we encounter a situation which we have to meet, we can't do anything about, and we don't understand. Linnea, Chuck, could you pass? Thanks, Nava.
I feel like there's the possibility, and I feel like I've heard that phrase used before, to indicate there are forces bigger than than I moving things, which isn't the same thing as I have to meet it. I don't understand it. It can be, but I feel like that shades it in a way that's not necessarily.
Well, I'm going to the when it's actually used. Something is happening. One has to meet it in some way. You don't really understand it. And you can't do much about it. Now, from there, one can attribute that situation to there being forces, but now you're moving into the story. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I see that as a second step. And so it's God's will, yes, there's this big force out there which is somehow associated with God and what have you. But I'm trying to move to the actual situation where it comes up. You follow?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. And what I want to suggest here is it's an expression of encountering mystery.
Can I say something? Sorry.
Why would I stop you, Raquel? Go for it.
I hear that, and it resonates. And so, therefore, if it's that moment of encountering mystery, I guess you're when you said naive approach, I thought that sounded a little harsh. Couldn't it just be cultural to then?
Oh, I wasn't talking about naive there. I was talking about naive when people thank Jesus for the Grammy. That's what I mean by naive.
But it's the same thing. I mean, they're there, and in that moment, they're like, okay. This is...
But they're into a story.
Right, I see what you're saying.
Okay.
So it's from the mystery to the story that...
And I want to... because what do we do when we encounter mystery? We tell stories. And this is what why art goes to, you know, we become passive, we don't know what to do, et cetera, all the things you were saying. But at the moment, it's encountering the mystery. Just in that moment. And then, why is that so uncomfortable? That we always, I mean, and there's been a very, very long tradition in human history of coming up with stories to explain what is happening, whether it's forces or God or karma or what have you. Well, why do we do this? Why do you do this, Kara?
I don't believe in that.
You don't believe in God, you don't believe in forces, you don't believe in karma, all of the above?
No, I believe in karma. I just wasn't raised in a Judeo-Christian tradition, and so I never had this, like, all-powerful bearded man who hit the smite button, you know, standing over my head. That's always how I pictured it, like, that my friends obsessed over somebody who literally sat at, like, a control screen with, like, a bless and smite, like, and then it was that black and white. I lost my train of thought. What was the question?
Why do we go to stories? What's so uncomfortable about the mystery?
Because no one wants to believe that they're not in control of their own destiny, their own future, their own life, their decisions.
Why not? Why is that so terrifying? Because it's evidently true.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have that fear, or at least I haven't for a while. I don't know.
Okay. Perry?
Well, it feels wide open.
And so?
And unfixed. And and there's no me there.
Okay. What's so terrifying about that?
Not necessarily terrifying, but there are many moments where it feels terrifying. It feels...
Yeah, why?
I want to be, you know, because I want to be somebody.
Okay.
Want to be somebody. Want to live forever. Want to get my emotional needs met. Oh.
the usual suspects, in other words. Steve.
It means I'm going to die.
That's a little bit of a jump for me. Can you bridge the gap there?
In its most, the essence of a lot of the distraction is, I think, to not have to really, and a lot of control, is to do anything but realize that I'm going to die.
cease to exist.
Cease to exist. And control, in its boiled down, is a way that I know I exist, and that maybe, and that I don't have to deal with or think about that. And when you start to let go of that, you start to be closer to, I'm actually dying, or I'm going to die, or this is
okay. So there's something very deep here. You can feel. On the one hand, we have the sense of existing. And then periodically in our lives, we encounter the fragility of our existence, that the world can function in a way which we cease to exist very quickly. Like there's a storm, or a tree falls on us, or get bitten by a snake.
An airplane falls on your head.
Yes, that's happened to somebody recently out in Corona. There's also the sense of wanting somehow to control or have a say in this experience we call life, and then encountering the situations where we realize, well, we don't actually have a say. There's situations we can do absolutely nothing about. Kara?
Is that a choose your own ending book that you've got next to you?
No.
Not?
This one?
Uh-huh.
No. So.
Those are how I explain karma to my friends. Sorry.
Oh, you choose your own ending. Well, you're going exactly where I was just about to go.
Sorry.
That's okay. In theistic religions, one ascribes the mystery to a supreme being and workings of his, her, or its wisdom / compassion / whatever will. In Buddhism, and actually in Hinduism, in Eastern religions, wasn't ascribed to a supreme being. The mystery was ascribed to the world itself, to the functioning of the world, the way the world functions. And it's fairly helpful in understanding this to consider that an analogy in our culture for the law of karma is the law of gravity. A lot of people project human values onto the universe, and this is also part of the mystery, of course. So a lot of people feel that karma is the force in the universe that makes the universe just. It's the, you know, so if you do bad, you get punished, and if you do good, you get rewarded. This, again, is a naive view of the world, because it immediately supposes there is good and there is bad, and you end up like a child in this one. That, I mean, that's why I call it naive. And morality that's based on such ideas as, if I do good, then I'll be rewarded, and if I do bad, then I'll be punished. This is a child's approach to morality. Is there any notion of good or bad connected with karma, with gravity? No. You know, I hold something up, I let it go, it falls. Exactly the same force is responsible for the Earth going around the Sun, for the formation of galaxies, etc. So it works on all scales, except when you get really, really small, then you get into the nuclear forces and so forth. But it works. It explains a lot of things. Can you ignore gravity?
At your peril.
At your peril. There's one series of cartoons in which gravity is regularly ignored. It's the Roadrunner cartoons, yes. But you will always notice that Wile E. Coyote can ignore gravity until he realizes he's ignoring gravity. Then it catches up with him really quickly. I think this also applies to karma. So that's one important analogy. It isn't a force or a law which provides balance to the universe that renders justice. These are all human projections of things that we value in human society, and that's it doesn't obtain out there. There's another analogy which is also very important. And that's the notion of evolution. We usually think of karma as cause and effect. That's how it's translated. But our notion of cause and effect, the popular notion that we're all familiar with is like, if I put my foot on the accelerator, the car goes, I cause the car to go faster. And if I put my foot on the brake, I cause the car to slow down. So there's a cause, there's a specific action, and there is a specific effect, and there's a connection between cause and effect. I have a friend who's works at one of the big pharmaceutical companies, the ones are into bioengineering. And one of the most difficult things to prove, particularly in this arena, is cause and effect. The standard saying in here is correlation is not causation. So you may have two things which occur together, or when this occurs, this one occurs. But to establish that this actually causes that is a very, very difficult research. And you have to construct quite careful experiments to do that. And from the scientific point of view, if you can establish a causation, that's really useful, because then you know the circumstances which predict which you can predict that certain things are going to happen. That's very helpful. But this is not what karma refers to at all. I've taught karma a number of times, and I've always been troubled by this translation of cause and effect, because it just didn't correlate very well with the explanations that I received about, which I'm going to go into in a moment. But the interpretation of it as cause and effect allows another form of naive interpretation to arise. And we get this, you know, a bus full of young kids goes over a cliff and everybody's killed. Why did that happen? Because in the last life, all of those kids were murderers. Uh, How many of you read James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man? No, it's a great book. He comes to the conclusion at the end, or somewhere in the book, that Catholicism is an inhuman, or it's inhumanly cruel. It's inhumanly cruel because it says you're born into this world eternally damaged and you can't, and you didn't have any choice about it. So this is just crazy. I have a similar view of this explanation of why those kids died. It presupposes that they did something in a previous life. And there's a whole judgment there. And it's unknowable. But that kind of, they did this, therefore they experienced this, cause and effect, again, is a way to try to get out of the mystery of things. Parents lost their children. It's a great tragedy. That's one of those events which we have to meet but cannot understand. And then there's a tendency to ascribe it to forces or the operation of beings or some kind of process which is a way of understanding it other than that it just happened. So when karma was one of my one of the favorite talks of Kelly Rinpoche, my teacher, and he would just talk about it over and over again, and he almost always talked about it in the same way. He always drew a diagram of a tree in which there is a seed which grew into a shoot, which grew into a tree, which produced leaves and fruit, which then became the seeds for other trees. That's not a cause and effect process. When you look at that process, that's an evolutionary process. Because as the seed grows, the seed disappears. The seed doesn't cause the tree, it grows into the tree. And then the leaves, and they're different from the wood, and the flowers are different from the leaves, and the fruit is different. And it's one thing evolving into another. So one of the best ways I've found to get a sense of what's being conveyed here is to use the analogy of evolution. And this is something I studied, read quite a little about quite a few years ago. And if you want to get into the technical side of it, look up complex adaptive systems, which are completely inanimate systems, which exhibit the process of evolution in absolutely fascinating ways, and as a result give rise to what is now called artificial life. There was a, in the early days of personal computers, one guy was on a vacation in Costa Rica, and he programmed a bunch of very simple programs into his computer memory, and they interacted, and if they interact in a certain way, they got more memory. That was the food. And somehow he hit upon it right, and he had this whole living, apparently living thing going on. There was absolutely no life in it all, but it looked alive. And that's been much more highly developed now. I'm going to come back to the analogy of evolution as we go further into karma. But karma is a way of understanding the world, and then we have to question, well, what's its role in spiritual practice? The role in spiritual practice, from my point of view, is that when you look at the world this way, you come to appreciate the potential significance of every thought and action that you have or do. Now, how many of you have experienced doing something that seemed innocuous at the time and turned into a complete disaster or opened up totally new possibilities for you that you never dreamed of? I think we've all experienced that. So, and in the spiritual domain, how we act is regarded as having a very important, a very high degree of influence on how we experience things. If you are mean and angry with people, how much peace do you experience? If you're open and generous with people, how much peace do you experience? Well, it's just a very simple example. And we have to come back to our original intention here. The purpose of practice is to end suffering. So a study of how our experience evolves from our actions might be a good idea. And that's really what's going on in this chapter. Now, as we've noted before, much of the language here is mythic. And it's using the mythic framework of past and future lives. But it's not so hard to decipher the code here and come to appreciate how actions that we do, motivations that we have, deeply shape and influence our subsequent experience of things. And because we're conditioned that way, then in those situations we are more likely to act in certain ways than others. And we put it all together, as it's said in another tradition, we have as much room to maneuver as a violin in a violin case. It's a pretty snug fit, you know. They don't want the violin rattling around too much. Very little room, but it's enough. Because, again, we get into other themes here of predeterminism and so forth. Karma determines, from the traditional explanation of karma, karma determines what we experience. And it predisposes us to experience it in a certain way, which, of course, powerfully influences the way that we're likely to act. But it doesn't determine that completely. So there's always this opening. And it doesn't determine it completely because, and this goes back to what we've studied earlier, of Buddha nature. Things are fundamentally groundless. So nothing is actually fixed. There's always the possibility of some openness. Now, how do we know this through our own experience? And this is very important. Because it's one thing to talk about this, but unless this is something we can actually know through our own experience, it's just words, it's just speculative philosophy, and doesn't have any power. So I want you to take any situation, take a challenging one or a difficult one, right now. And open to the experience of it. So let mind and heart and body settle. Now, usually when we recall a specific situation and we start opening to the experience of it, we immediately remember the situation and we start telling a story about it. This happened and this happened, I did this. And we can get quite elaborate stories, but I just want you to recall the situation. And instead of starting with the stories, call the situation in mind and note what arises in your body. And let yourself experience to the extent that you're able to what arises in your body. Don't try to change it or manipulate it or control it. If it's very uncomfortable, just let it in a little bit, just to the degree that you can actually stay with it. That's one aspect of the experience of that particular situation. So just breathe, resting in that experience, just the physical reaction, if you wish, or the physical sensations that arise in your body associated with that experience. It's not necessary to do any body scanning or anything like that, just open to the whole body. See what's there and let yourself experience it. And then include the emotions that arose at that time. Now, what arises in the body and what arises emotionally are only echoes of what arose, but it's good enough for our purposes right now. You may find a story start to run in your head. As soon as you note that, come back to your body, be clear about the physical reactions, the physical sensations, and then include the emotions. So you're resting in both the physical sensations and the emotional sensations. Now, quite often by this time, one's whole sense of the situation has already shifted. Which means the stories have shifted. So include the stories now, along with the other two. Maybe they're the same stories that arose, maybe they're different ones, but just include all of them. Just like leaves swirling in the wind. But stay in touch with the sensations in the body. Okay, so you do all this. What happens? Anybody? What happens? Raquel?
Well, I needed more time and I didn't have a shift, but I could at least tell what stories I could kind of see through some of the stories as baloney and then others as maybe not sure, having to look at a little closer.
So your relationship with your previous experience began to shift.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Steve?
Energy started to disperse, break up, diffuse.
The emotional charge, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what was the result of that?
More attention.
Mm-hmm.
A little more, I don't know, a little freedom, I guess.
Okay, a little more freedom. Anybody else?
Spaces that I wasn't aware of before opened up.
Okay. So I've heard from three people. What's the common theme? There's a shift. Okay. I said before, we have as much room to move as a violin in a violin case. What I was pointing you to, was you have that always that ability to open to the experience and then all kinds of possibilities. Now, how likely are you to do that in any given situation? On a rating between 1 and 100, how likely are you are to do that in a given situation? 2%. Yeah, something like that. Pretty accurate. 98% of the time, if we take the 2 figure, we run. You know, we don't move at all. But the possibility, the potential is always there. That's what I wanted to point out. It's always there. It may seem like a very little thing just to start bringing attention. But as soon as we do, all kinds of other possibilities arise. What karma determines is the 98%. That's conditioning. That's what we're most likely to do. Unless we reach for the other 2%.
Can you
say that again? Yeah. Karma is about the 98%. Or let's say the karma of samsara is about the 98%. What we're doing in Buddhist practice in general is building a capacity of attention so that we can reach for the 2% a little more frequently, maybe move it up to 3. If you get it up over 5, you'll generally be regarded as a saint. So it's not that big a deal to become a saint, you see. Yes, go ahead.
Is it just my imagination, or does karma ripen more quickly the more you practice?
It's a way of describing one's experience. I don't think... Let's use our analogies. The heavier the ball, does gravity operate any faster? Does anything change the rate at which things evolve? Like seed, you put fertilizer, sunlight, things like that. So I don't think we can say that karma speeds up the ripening. However, if you put it a different way, You ever been on the TGV in France? No. It's this train which moves at 150, 200 miles an hour. You have no sense that you're moving that fast. It's so smooth. So ordinarily, that's how we are. We're moving really, really fast. No. Try opening a window and sticking your hand out, and you suddenly become aware of it. What practice does is you become aware of what's happening, and now you begin to see things. And so there's the subjective experience that it speeds things up, but actually you're just seeing things evolving in you. And it's pretty terrifying. Right? Yeah. Kara.
Well, but what if you're really working in the direction of change? You know, like you could have spent those 3 years that you were in retreat, you know, working at the Jiffy Lube and not working in the direction of change.
That's true. And so what are you asking?
Well,
yes, if you don't cultivate attention, then things just become more and more solidified.
Well, like in Hinduism, there's this idea of, you know, tapas, of spiritual fire, of like the more practice you do, the more heat you build up, mm-hmm. so to speak. And the more heat you build up, the faster you're burning your karma, so to speak.
I think that's an interpretation of experience. The more heat you build up, the more energy you have available for attention, the more energy you have available for attention, the more clearly you see things.
Right.
The notion that you're actually burning stuff up.
Well, I don't really concur with that, but yeah. I mean that it also would seem like the more it seems things get thrown at you.
Well, yes. Sit on the sidewalk cafe on Sunset Boulevard, have a cup of coffee. You don't feel like cars are coming at you, do you?
Not.
But walk into the street, how do you feel? That's all the differences. The cars are going by you, you know, but most of the time we're just ignoring it. When you actually open up, oh, this is what's going on, then... So again, the tendency is to say, well, I'm doing this, it's causing this to happen. No, all we're doing is becoming more aware of what is actually going on all the time. You know, this is why Gunaratna, in his book, Mindfulness in Plain English, has this to say about meditation. Somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with a sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. No problem. You are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way, and you never noticed. And this is what more or less everybody experiences when they first practice meditation. It's insane in here.
Shut up.
Yeah, that goes on too. And I mean, I have so many people who come after, they come to me and they talk about meditation, I get the meditation instruction, sometimes they call me 2 days later, sometimes they come back after 2 weeks. Often they'll call me up just before they're to come 2 weeks, says, I don't think there's any point in coming to see you because I wasn't able to have a quiet mind at all. And I just don't think I'm cut out for this at all. And I mean, there's so many people who said that. Say, yeah, that sounds like you've had the first experience of meditation. What? Say, no, it's the first experience of meditation. Huh? Your mind's completely crazy. Yeah. So I don't think I'm suitable. No, that's just the first experience of meditation. So... But one tends to project it and make it into something other than it is. So burning things up, accelerating karma, et cetera, all of this. These are just stories we tell ourselves to explain what we're experiencing. It just means that we're a little more aware of what's going on. Randy.
For a lot of years, philosophers have debated determinism versus free will.
Yeah.
And for reasons that sounded good at the time, but I can't quite recall, I seem to remember that the general consensus was that they're mutually exclusive. It's a one or the other.
Aristotelian logic.
Yeah. And now we have evolution or gravity, which are completely 100% deterministic. But we have that little bit of wiggle room around the violin.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out how they can be compatible.
Well,
let me bring in one more idea, the idea of making meaning and the illusion of free will in the exercise of making meaning.
Well, first, I want to remind you that these were analogies. They weren't equivalences. I think it's highly arguable that evolution is completely deterministic. Because even in systems which in which there is no life present, chance plays a huge role, and so this is what gives rise to chaos theory, and from chaos theory, the complex adaptive system theory.
But uncertainty isn't free will.
Ooh. The whole the whole discussion of free will versus determinism is a form of reductionism. There's a quotation I came across in a book. I can't remember the author's name, John Burdett or something like that. Bangkok. This one's Bangkok Haunts. This is his third one about Bangkok. They're completely over the top things. But the quotation I rather liked was, the revelation that A is not A does not come naturally to undivided minds. So we have free will and determinism. Well, in Buddhism, we're quite happy with this kind of thing. We have form and emptiness. Is there a problem here? And Buddhism doesn't actually follow Aristotelian logic, because Aristotelian logic doesn't present an accurate picture of our world. We experience form and emptiness, and we experience them simultaneously in everything. We experience free will and determinism. They aren't mutually exclusive. This goes right back to the discussion my interjection of Wittgenstein, because these are, free will doesn't exist as a principle. It describes an experience we have. Determinism doesn't exist in principle. It describes another experience we have. We have both of those experiences. So trying to say there's one or the other. This is making things out of experiences, and there aren't any things out there. And so now you argue about these things you made up. Well, you can play that game if you want, but it doesn't edify or move anything forward. And from Buddhist point of view, we're only interested in being able to know our experience completely. And we have free will sometimes, and we have determinism other times. Sometimes we have both together. That's how it is. Yeah. Kara, and then Steve, and Isher. Steve?
When I was sitting in the hall, I had an experience which happens a lot in meditation. After about 15 minutes, all of a sudden, I realized that a woman was had been talking on the phone the whole time. So I was obviously in that was a shift when all of a sudden I brought mm-hmm. in, and the, and I was, it was like, wow, she's been talking the whole time, and I had no idea. So relating that to the discussion of karma, is that shift, is the karma what is fueling the distraction for those 15 minutes when I don't even hear someone who's 25 feet away from me, and the shift when the forces of karma aren't as much at play? Is that?
I think one's reaching here a bit. Another analogy is conditioning. And so you've trained yourself, so you practice. And that's a form of conditioning. And then we have all the other forms of conditioning. One is training so that there is more awareness, more attention operating, and other forms of conditioning so there's less and less attention operating. So there you are, sitting in meditation, and you become aware of something that you weren't aware of before. That may be a distraction, or it may be an increase in attention. I don't know, actually. Depends on your experience of it, and depends on, you know, did you get involved in the conversation, or it just something that was there and you continued to rest? That would be the differentiation. So I don't think we need to reduce it, you know, try to figure out, is this karma or not? Karma is simply a term which is talking about the way experience evolves, or we can say the way conditioning evolves into experience. And that's what we're going to go into. In the do I answer your question?
I'm sort of getting a little bit at there's a concept, and we have of, you know, Kara said burning karma, but we not using it as a metaphor, yeah, of being able to not be at the mercy of the cycle of it. And I'm wondering, yeah, if awareness
you're not at the from the traditional point of view, and I'll give a traditional description because it's easier at this point. When the experience arises, that is, let's say, when I get sick, that's regarded as the pain. That's the end of the karmic process. How I experience that determines whether the conditioning continues or not. If I then go out and do things which make me increase the likelihood that I will fall into ill health, or I get really angry with people and things like that, then I'm just, it's conditioning on conditioning, and things get more and more solidified. If I allow myself to experience the illness or the disturbance as completely as possible, in just the way we were touching into earlier, then I experience it, but because I'm experiencing it in attention, I'm not being conditioned. I'm not setting in motion another conditioning process. You follow? Mm-hmm. And so that's what ends the karmic cycle. Okay. Now, this brings us to, you know, what is karma? Well, Kenshuk Jeltsin and Gunther translate this in two very different ways. That's why it's useful having these. Kenshuk Jeltsin translates this: what is karma? It is the karma of mind and the karma of thought. And karma is created by the mind and by its force. And all karma from the mind and its thought. that's on page 111 in Kencho Jiaotsen's translation. Now, how helpful is that? Doesn't say much, does it? Gunther tries to be a little more helpful. What is karma? It is motivation and motivatedness. A good German-English word, motivatedness. You see, in German, you can take any word and you can just add on syllables and they all affect the meanings and you can make words arbitrarily long. Motivatedness, of course, is not an English word, but we have an idea. So does that help? Karma is motivation and motivatedness. Well, a little bit. The words in Tibetan are sem and sam. Sem is the word that is usually translated as mind, can also be translated as heart. You have awakening mind. It's the same word. It's not being used in quite the same way, perhaps, but it's the same word. So when we say awakening mind is precious, that is, it's in Tibetan is Jiangchup Sem in the Rinpoche. And then the word for motivatedness is sam. Now, in Tibetan, there's often not a clear distinction, depending on the word, between the word being used as a verb, a noun, or an adjective, or even an adverb. So we can say, one way to understand this is that karma is, and we could translate this a number of ways. We could say karma is thinking. We could also say karma is intending. And the other part of it would be karma is thought, because that's the result of thinking. Or karma is the action that comes from intention. That's what the sam would refer to. So this is very interesting, because what's being said here is that karma is this, just put this in very simple terms, it's moving in a certain direction and doing it. Well, that describes everything. Now, if we go back to where we were at the beginning of this evening's discussion, the whole notion of karma and God's will was to try to give some kind of way of relating to mystery. And what Buddha's saying here is, what arises in our experience, it seems to be a mystery, but it is a result of our own intention. Now, in New Age, which a good friend of mine says should always be pronounced to rhyme with sewage, the idea is that you make your life, you know, and you have control of your life. And again, there is a great deal of naivety here, is that you should just be able to think your way out of cancer and just take the right attitude and be cured. And this is just nonsense. But the principle or the idea that our intention or how we approach things and what we do shapes our experience. Well, yeah, this is very true. This is very true and very profoundly true. And it gives us a way of relating to situations when they seem incomprehensible. That is, oh, somehow or other, this has come about, and it's my energy coming back to me in a way. And what's really important now is how I meet this. In other words, do I continue the cycle of conditioning, or do I stop it here? So in this sense, karma is about a way of giving us agency in this world, which seems beyond explanation and mystery. So it's very much about being an active agent in this. That is, we can shape our experience. How? By paying attention to what we actually intend and do. That's very powerful. It shouldn't be understood in the naive way that we can, or the childish way. It's like, oh, I just have to think good thoughts and everything will be fine. It doesn't work quite that simply. And why? Because of the process of evolution. There is a great deal of stuff that's accumulated. There's a great deal of momentum. And you can't just ignore that. It's like climbing onto a 16-foot wave and thinking, well, this is just like a paddle and things like that. No, you're right. You know, you're on a 16-foot wave. I'm really thinking of that right now because I met with somebody yesterday, old student of mine, who's a surfer, and he was nursing what he thinks is a broken rib because he came down on his board rather hard and on a very large wave that he was surfing while there were the fires in the, because the winds were so high at that point, surfing was very good. So there is this sense of agency here that we can actually shape our experience, but that we also have to keep in mind there is the accumulated momentum of all of the conditioning, which is our previous intention. And that's why things don't turn around overnight, unfortunately. That's why we only have as much room to wiggle as a violin in a violin case.
The culmination of momentum from our previous what?
Intentions. Conditions, intentions, and things like that. Because every time we act, there's energy that goes into that, and that energy solidifies into conditioning. And now, whereas we had this amount of movement before, now we may only have this amount of movement. And if we don't exercise any attention in our lives, then you know very well what happens, because you can see it in the people around. We get smaller and smaller and narrower, more and more fixed. And I remember going to a concert at UCLA. A friend of mine had tickets, and we were in the founder circle. And, so there are all of these people there who are, you know, in latter stages of their life, and many of these, many of the men had been very successful professionals or business people. And what astounded me is the rigidity in their bodies. And they walked around like this. And there was, everything had solidified. This was the price they had paid for their lives. There was no movement, no fluidity, nothing in their body. They're just, and I mean, it was really strange to watch them, because almost all of them walked around like you're the Tin Man, you know, just like this. That's all they could move. And you can just see how much it solidified. And we see this in the course of growing older, that, you know, things get more and more solid, and you get less and less flexible, and the many factors. But one of the things that you're doing in practice is cultivating attention. Is you're undoing a lot of that conditioning, and creating the possibility of openness, freedom, creativity, and what have you. Let's look briefly at the classification of the discussion, and then maybe we'll start on the discussion too. He's going to discuss it under six topics. Classification of karma. And it says, I'm not sure what he means by ascription here. Oh, the primary characteristics. So it's just to put this in plain English. Oh. Interesting choice of words there. What are the different types of karma? What are the primary characteristics? What does each one look like? This term ascription refers to what owns the karma, roughly? And what are the results? And then the next two are very much about the evolutionary characteristics. Increase from the small means that small grows into large results, and inevitability, you can't escape it. Now, it's easy to talk about these in terms of like this force which acts on you, but how I want to look at this is as just stuff that happens that makes perfect common sense, and it's not something that's being done to us, but a process that we set in motion. So let me talk a little bit about these the three classifications here. Non-meritorious karma and result, meritorious karma and result, karma and result of unshakable meditative concentration. Actually, there are a couple more. One of the key things, and we discussed this back at the beginning of this course, any description of spiritual practice has to answer several key questions. Why are things the way they are? Why this is a problem? what you can do about this problem, or what a solution to this problem looks like, and how you can put this solution into effect. That's basically the Four Noble Truths. If you look at karma in terms of conditioning and in terms of agency, as I've been talking about, then it puts our fate in our own hands, because our fate, or what happens to us and what we experience, is dependent on our own actions. And that, to me, is the real import of karma. Then, when it goes into non-meritorious karma and its result, what it's describing is, when you act this way, it's going to involve into these kinds of experiences. And when it describes meritorious karma and its result, it's going to say, when you act these ways, like being generous and helping people and so forth, this will evolve into these kinds of experiences. And then the one for meditative concentration says, if you meditate and develop these states, then you will have these kinds of experiences. In addition to all of that, there are ways of acting, which we call practice and so forth, which set in a very different process, which is not one of the conditioning becoming more and more solidified, but becoming freer and freer of conditioning. This is also a form of karma, but it's one in which more and more possibilities are being created because one is not continuing or initiating or continuing the conditioning process. That's what's going to be discussed when we get into the discussion of how to generate awakening mind, bodhicitta, that particular path. Right now, what Gampopa's concern is to show that functioning, any form of functioning under the usual subject-object dualism, i.e., the way we experience things in samsara, inevitably leads to a solidification of conditioning. And with that, the denial or the negating the possibility of freedom. Now, next week we'll go through the 10 non-virtuous and 10 virtuous actions in the Facebook assignment. I suggested you look at these, and I'd like you to look at these over the next couple of weeks and really observe what happens in you when you do something unwholesome or non-meritorious versus what happens in you when you do something that's meritorious. So you might, for instance, intentionally lie to somebody over the next week. It doesn't have to be a big lie. It doesn't have to be damaging or anything like that. Just say something that isn't true. And the point here is to observe very, very closely what happens in you. What I'm particularly interested in is, can you stay completely present in that process? And if you can, then what's that like? And if you can't, what point do you check out? Where exactly do you check out? What's going on there? Do the same for meritorious actions, virtuous actions. Can you stay completely present when you give something to somebody? Do you stay completely present when you do that? If not, where do you check out in that? I also want you to look at not only the literal interpretation of these actions, but also the figurative interpretation. So, for instance, taking of life. How many times in the course of a conversation have you killed somebody else's idea? Stealing. We have a wonderful expression in English. She stole his affection. Have you ever done that? What else have you stolen? Somebody's trust. So, what I'm suggesting is you look at these in figurative ways too. In the area of speech, harsh language, slander, so forth, ordinarily this is interpreted in terms of our interaction with other people. How do you talk with yourself? Do you always tell the truth to yourself, or maybe you don't have to tell somebody a lie. Maybe you just have to observe yourself lying to yourself. Can you stay present in that? That should be an interesting exercise. So I'd like you to look at this, both the virtuous and the non-virtuous. As I say, this is one of Rinpoche's favorite topics. Not, I believe, because he liked to lecture on morality. But I think it's because paying attention to our actions is the very foundation of the path. There's a famous verse from the Dhammapada. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Train your mind. These are the Buddha's teachings. Very simple. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Train your own mind. These are the Buddha's teachings. So, by becoming one of the easiest ways to change is, you know, to change a system, is to institute a different feedback mechanism in the system. And, you know, there's all this stuff about how do you change this, how do you change that. But basically it all comes down to is changing the feedback mechanisms. It's one way of looking at this chapter. Is to, all of this information is to lead you to reappraise how you view the way that you are acting in your life. And if you change your view of that, then you've changed the feedback mechanism, and then everything else can change. So people sometimes think they have to exert great efforts to change. No, most of the time you just have to change one little bit there, and an awful lot of other things will just follow from that. Difficulty may be in finding that one little bit to change, but we'll talk about that as we go forward, okay? So I think that's probably enough for this evening. We're 9:30. You can stop recording.